Okay. I want to start by saying that I had to submit the title this year a month ago, and as I was preparing it, it sort of evolved. So I changed my title a little bit, and if anybody wants to leave right now, I will not be offended. I changed it to Mindfulness and Jewish Practice. We're not going to talk only about Kavanah, but we're going to talk about mindfulness and how it plays into Jewish practice in general. So if you were really excited about spending 45 minutes talking about Kavanah and you want to switch to a different shiur, that's fine. You're welcome to do that. I want to ask, before I start, I want to ask, raise your hand if you are familiar with mindfulness, with the definition of mindfulness. Okay, if you could show me on five fingers, five being like you're an expert in mindfulness and one being I know a little bit. How much do you feel you know about mindfulness? A little. You're like, that's why I'm here, right? Okay, I'm going to ask you one more question. If you could show on five fingers, how comfortable do you feel practicing mindfulness? How much do you feel you use mindfulness in your daily life? Okay. Okay, great. So I'm glad to see a lot of zeros and ones and twos, because I kind of feel in the same boat. And this could be like our support group, and we'll all work on mindfulness together. I actually chose this topic of mindfulness because it's something that I've been trying to work on, and I thought if I'm going to spend a lot of time preparing a shiur, I should prepare something that, you know, I can work on as I'm doing it. And I'll tell you how bad it is, how much I need to work on it. When I sat down to start preparing the shiur, I had sat down in front of my computer and I opened up like a blank source sheet. I put on a few things that I already had in mind, and then I opened up like 15 tabs, and I had like every single shiur I could find about mindfulness, and every source sheet I could find that connected to mindfulness, and then I had like TED Talks open related to mindfulness, and I had my laundry going at the same time, and I was folding laundry, and I'm thinking as I'm listening to all these things and, you know, putting sources on my source sheet, I thought, this is really ironic that I'm multitasking as I'm preparing my shiur about mindfulness. So I've definitely become more aware of it, even just in the process of preparing this shiur. And one thing that I'm really grateful for is to be Jewish, because in Judaism, mindfulness is something that's so much a part of our constant practice. And I think as much as there's a movement in the outside world, you know, yoga and meditation and all these different ways of practicing mindfulness, we don't really have to go any further than the things that we're already doing in our daily lives as Jews in order to work on mindfulness. And what I found as I started thinking about it and working on it is that there's like this two-way relationship between Jewish practice and mindfulness. On the one hand, the more we work on our Jewish practice, the more we take the things that we're already doing in our daily lives and we make them better, and we do them more according to the way that they're supposed to be done, the more we increase our mindfulness, and the more we find we're more connected, and we're more centered, and we're more balanced. And the opposite is also true. The more we worked on mindfulness, the more it improves our Jewish practice. So what I want to show you today is five examples of that, five things that we do in our everyday life as Jews that really involve mindfulness practices, and hopefully, as we become more aware of these opportunities to work on mindfulness, these daily practices that we do will become more meaningful and will bring more mindfulness into our daily lives. So that's the plan. Okay. Okay, I want to start with a definition of mindfulness. People who are maybe more well-versed in mindfulness will tell you that there's a lot of different definitions, and it depends on the context in which mindfulness is used, but I want to all start with the same definition so we know what we're talking about. This definition comes from psychologist Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's considered like the modern-day father of mindfulness, and he says, mindfulness is awareness that arises through paying attention on purpose in the present moment, non-judgmentally. And I want to unpack that for a second. I broke it up by these three lines because I think those are three separate components.
It's all good.
Do you want to grab some more?
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, so we have these three elements. Number one is paying attention on purpose. The world that we live in, we have so much stuff going on. We all have a million things on our plate. We can't possibly pay attention to everything that we have going on. And we have a million stimuli that are confronting us all the time. So by default, what's going to attract our attention is like whatever screams the loudest, whatever's the flashiest, whatever's the loudest, or whatever's the most urgent thing, that's what's going to attract our attention. And mindfulness says, don't let the outside world dictate what's going to take your attention. You make a decision about what you want to pay attention to. And the best mindfulness exercises are taking something that you would never notice otherwise and making a decision, I'm going to pay attention to this thing. I'm going to pay attention to it even though it's there all the time and I take it for granted. I'm going to pay attention to it even though it doesn't require my attention because it's going to keep happening whether I pay attention to it or not. And I'm going to pay attention to it even though it's very quiet and unassuming. So what's the classic example? Paying attention to, like in yoga, your breath, right? Like, that's not something you would normally pay attention to, but that's a mindfulness exercise. Pay attention on purpose. Just pay attention to breathing in and breathing out. Or pay attention to the sensation of the chair behind you right now, which you would never normally think about. Or pay attention to the thoughts and the feelings that are coming up for you, which are so easy to ignore. So that's paying attention on purpose. The second aspect is in the present moment, which is also so hard nowadays. In the present moment means in the present moment in space and in the present moment in time. So if you're anything like me, most of the time, you're either stressing about things that have already happened or you're stressing about things that are going to happen, and you're very rarely thinking about what's happening right now. Also, in the present space means I'm not reading a book that's taking me somewhere else. I'm not watching a movie that's taking me somewhere else. I'm not communicating with somebody who's in a different place. I'm just here, which is something that's a big challenge nowadays. And the last component is non-judgmentally. And when non-judgmentally is used in the context of mindfulness, it's talking about not judging our own thoughts and feelings. Because we can sometimes get into this crazy cycle in our head of, you know, I'm in yoga, let's say, and I'm trying to clear my mind, but this thought keeps entering my mind. And why does that thought keep entering my mind? And why am I stressed about that? I thought I'd already gotten over that. And then we keep just kind of going in circles in our head. So mindfulness says, don't judge your thoughts and feelings. Just kind of notice them and say, oh, that's interesting that that's there. And if it's serving you, you can hold on to it. And if it's not serving you, you let it go. Those are the three components of mindfulness. So I wanted to break those three components apart because they don't all apply all the time in Judaism. They apply at different times depending on what the context is. So I want to start, now, model number one is brachot. I think brachot is a great example of the first two elements. Paying attention on purpose and in the present moment. If there's something that demands that we kind of put everything else aside and pay attention to what's happening or what I'm doing right now, I think that would be brachot. We have 15 brachot that we say every morning, Birkot HaShachar, where we thank Hashem for things that we would otherwise take for granted. And the way that we say these brachot typically nowadays is we open up our siddur and at some point in the morning we say these 15 brachot in one sitting. But originally, we were supposed to say them as we experience those things, in the moment. So if you look here at the Gemara in brachot, upon hearing the sound of the rooster, one should recite, blessed who gave the heart understanding to distinguish between day and night. Or your alarm clock, or whatever, you know, the modern day equivalent is. When your alarm clock goes on, you should say, that's so great, my alarm clock is working. That's so great that I was able to wake up today. And there's like many deeper meanings of this, the understanding to distinguish between day and night. Day and night in Judaism can represent good and bad. You know, we're so fortunate that we have a moral compass. We're able to distinguish between good and bad. We're so fortunate that we're able to distinguish between happiness and sadness, that we have, that we're tuned to human emotions. However we think about this bracha, just not taking that moment for granted. Upon opening his eyes, one should recite, blessed who gives sight to the blind. Upon sitting up straight, one should recite, blessed who sets captives free. These translations, I mean, there are many different ways to translate the words of each bracha, so this is just one translation from Sefaria, but there are many different ways of understanding each one, but the idea is there regardless. When something happens, you don't just let it pass you by. Pay attention on purpose. And there's a risk in the fact in Judaism that we have habits that we develop, right? Everything is a routine. So it's good that it's a routine because that means it's integrated into our daily lives, but the risk with a routine is that it becomes superficial. And we're just like mumbling the words and we're not really paying attention to what they mean. It's something that we have the challenge we have to work on. But I think all of the halachot of brachot are always trying to bring us back to the meaning and bring us back to being present in that moment. Because every time I eat a food, I have to say a bracha. But depending on what food I'm eating, I make a different bracha. So every single time I eat something, I have to think about what I'm eating and where my food comes from. Like, what are the ingredients in this food that I'm eating, and what is the dominant ingredient, and, you know, where does that food come? Does it come from a tree? Does it come from the ground? Does it come from an animal? And then if I switch locations in the middle of when I'm eating, I might have to make a new bracha. And then when I finish eating, I have to think about how quickly did I eat and how much did I eat and, you know, what did I eat and do I now make an after bracha? So I'm always thinking about what I'm doing. That's mindfulness in brachot. And there are so many examples of that in brachot. I mean, if you hear thunder or lightning or you go to an incredible, beautiful place or the sight of a miracle or you meet an incredible person, be in that moment and don't take it for granted. Okay, that's model number one. Model number two is chesed, acts of kindness toward others. And I think this is a place we don't normally think about mindfulness, because mindfulness we usually associate with ourselves and our relationship with ourselves, not so much our relationship with others. But I want to ask you to think about this question. Have you ever had somebody do chesed for you? Somebody was trying to do something nice for you, and it wasn't nice, and you kind of wish they just hadn't bothered. Can you think of an example of that? Yeah? A few people, that's resonating with them. Okay, and then I want to ask you, if the person had been paying a little bit better attention, or a little more present, or a little less judgmental, would that have made the chesed feel better? Right? So I think we normally think about mindfulness as my relationship with myself, but we have to be so mindful when we're interacting with others also. So I want to talk about these three components of mindfulness and how they apply to chesed. Number one, being in the present moment, okay? Being in the present moment when you're doing chesed. So there's a concept in halacha, and it's brought up many times in the Gemara. I just brought one example here from the Gemara in Sukkah, that ha'osik b'mitzvah patur min ha'mitzvah. One who is engaged in a mitzvah is exempt from another mitzvah. And the example here is with regards to the scribes of Torah scrolls, phylacteries, and mezuzot. They themselves, the scribes, and the merchants who sell them, and the merchants who purchase them from the first merchants and sell them to others, and all who are engaged in the labor of heaven are all exempt from all mitzvot that are mentioned in the Torah while they are engaged in that labor. Now, it's a little bit complicated halachically. I'm not going to get into the details. Like, you can't just use this as, like, whenever I want to get out of a mitzvah, I'll just do another mitzvah. Ideally, we try to, you know, cover all the mitzvot. But theoretically, if your job, and you work 9 to 5, and your job is doing something that is involving a mitzvah, and during that time you cannot stop for anything else, and the time elapses to daven mincha, let's say, you don't think about davening mincha. You just do the mitzvah that's at hand. If you're helping an old lady cross the street, and it takes longer than you expected, and you miss an opportunity to do another mitzvah, you're not looking at your watch. You're just there doing the mitzvah that you're doing. It applies to any mitzvah, almost any mitzvah. And chesed is a mitzvah. So that means that if I'm visiting somebody in the hospital, or I'm at a shiva house, or I'm preparing a meal for somebody who needs it, or I'm watching my kids, then I'm just doing that thing, and I'm not thinking about even any other mitzvah. I'm just in the present moment. And that really affects the quality of the chesed that we're doing, because you can kind of feel when somebody's there and they're not really there, you know, or you're like item number 4 on their list of 25 things to do, and you kind of get that sense. So that's the aspect of being present. And I wanted to share this quote from a book that I recommend. I'm in the middle of reading it. It's by Tal Ben-Shachar. who studied happiness and perfectionism, and he's a professor at Harvard, and he is like a recovering perfectionist, and he tells his own story within the book, and he says, this is how he talks about multitasking. He says, while trying to do it all, part of my frustration came from my inability to focus on one thing at a time. For example, I tried to squeeze in work-related phone calls or emails when the kids were home because I felt like I didn't get enough work done in the office. While at work, I spent a lot of time on the phone with my wife because we didn't feel satisfied with our conversations, which were being constantly disrupted at home. I tried with little success to read while on the exercise bike, and my mind wandered constantly to my children while I tried to rest in child's pose on the yoga mat. I was a polygamist of sorts. Feeling unfulfilled in each one of these areas, I tried to make up for it by engaging in more than one activity simultaneously. With the change from a perfectionist fantasy to an optimal, good enough existence, without my noticing it at first, I also changed to a serial monogamist, engaging in each of the different activities exclusively separately. When I was with my children, I was with them while the computer and phone were off. My friends got my undivided attention when we were together. When my wife and I were on a date, it was our time to share and to love. At work, when writing, my phone and my email were off, as they are now, and I was fully focused on the task. And when working out, I was much more likely to enjoy a meditative unity of mind and body. From an unfulfilled polygamist, I became a much more satisfied serial monogamist. This is something I really relate to. I really like to be productive, and it feels like I could be more productive if I'm doing a million things at once. There's also kind of like an adrenaline rush from it. And I knew that it was really bad when this book showed up on my doorstep from Amazon, and I had never ordered it. And my cousin, God bless her, just decided that this might be a good read for me, and she sent it to me. It's been helpful. But I think it really made me realize that, you know, as much as we think we're accomplishing so much by multitasking, we're not really doing any of the things that we're doing. So we want to try to be osik b'mitzvah and just fully invest in whatever we're currently doing. The second aspect of mindfulness is about paying attention on purpose. So the thing about chesed is that there are no hard and fast do's and don'ts. You have to pay attention to the situation. You have to know the person who's in front of you. You have to know the time. You have to know the place. And you have to assess, is this the right time? Is this the right place? How do I apply the principles of chesed here? So there are many examples of this, but I'm just going to bring two. The first example is about a shiva house. If you're comforting a mourner, the comforters are not permitted to begin a conversation until the mourner begins one first. So that requires that we also be just there. You know, sometimes you're just sitting there waiting. Sometimes it's silent. Sometimes you're just waiting to kind of feel where the person's at. But it's telling us, like, pay attention on purpose. Don't walk in with an agenda of what you're going to say or with a thought of what you're going to say. Kind of feel it out and see, where is the person holding? What do they want to talk about? What, you know, where are they feeling comfortable? And the second source here from Avot is, do not comfort them when their dead lie before them. You also have to know when is the right time to even start comforting. There's times that you don't even go there because it's not time yet. So you have to pay attention. You have to pay attention, be sensitive to the moment, to the situation, to the person. And the second example I wanted to bring was about tzedakah. When we're little kids, we think tzedakah is like the easiest mitzvah ever. You just put a penny in the box, and then it's magical. Like, I don't know how it gets to help somebody, but, you know, you put it in the box, and you just did tzedakah. But really, it's much more complicated, and the Rambam explains here, you're obligated to give the poor person what he lacks. If he doesn't have clothing, clothe him. If he doesn't have furniture, buy him furniture. If he's single, marry him off. Even if the poor person used to be extremely rich and ride a horse and have a slave to run before him, and the poor person becomes impoverished, buy him a horse to run and a slave to run before him. As it says, make up to him his lack, which he lacks, and you're commanded to make up what he lacks, but not to enrich him. So it's like a very delicate balance. And the Rambam doesn't even get to, well, how are you supposed to know what the person needs? Presumably, you have to talk to them, like, or, you know, kind of get to know them or do research about that person, or, you know, sometimes it's not even what they say, but what they don't say, or the way that they say it. You have to be sensitive to what is the right way to do this mitzvah right now. That's paying attention on purpose. And the same is true with not only being aware of the other person, but being aware of ourselves as we're doing chesed. Because the Rambam explains, anyone who gives tzedakah to a poor person with a scowl and causes him to be embarrassed, even if he gave him 1,000 zuz, has destroyed and lost any merit thereby. And Rabbi Brand, I was just at a book club with Rabbi Brand last week, and he said, like, the same is true of any other mitzvah, any other interpersonal mitzvah. If you're trying to do something nice for your parents, and you do it with a sour face, that was not kibud avayim. So we also have to be aware of ourselves. What is my state of mind right now? Am I doing this in a calm way, in a pleasant way? What is my facial expression as I'm doing this? And be sensitive to the moment and to the situation. The last piece of mindfulness is being non-judgmental. And I did a lot of thinking about how this applies in Judaism, because we are a little judgmental in Judaism. Yeah. Like, well, you know, we do believe that there's, like, certain rights and wrongs, and, you know, if I'm having a certain thought or a certain emotion, it might not be correct, according to Judaism. And there might be a time and place for judging, but I think what mindfulness would say about that is that you need to first accept, this is like psychologist Carl Rogers, you need to first accept before you can change. If I don't even allow myself to accept and to admit that I'm having this emotion or this thought, then I'm not really going to be able to fix it. So that's the, you know, Bein Adam L'Atzmi piece, that's the piece of being aware of ourselves. But when it comes to our relationships with others, we're definitely encouraged to reserve judgment in Judaism. And there are two Mishnayot here that I wanted to bring from Avot. The first one talks about Ezehu Chacham Halomed Mikol Adam, who is a wise person, somebody who learns from everybody. And in order to learn from everybody, you have to really go into that interaction with an open mind. And as I'm listening to you, I'm not thinking, I'm not evaluating everything that you're saying. I'm not judging it. I'm not comparing it to what I think or what I do. I'm just thinking, that's so interesting. I'm so curious about that. Where is that coming from? I wonder what I can learn from that. And Rabbi Simcha Zissel Ziv, the founder of Kalm Yeshiva, is called the Altar of Kalm. He says, every person has a special feeling for a certain endeavor, will be extremely sensitive when he, I don't know why I keep switching between she and he, sorry about that, when she sees any little thing having to do with that endeavor. For example, when a tailor meets someone, he will immediately look at his clothes, and the shoemaker at the shoes, the milliner at the hat. Similarly, a merchant will be very sensitive to any words or actions that will have an impact on his merchandise. Another type of person would not see or hear any of these things, because her heart is not given to inquire and investigate anything from these matters, because he has no desire for them. All of this, if one is not engaged in such activities, will not notice them when performed by others. If this is the case, then one who learns from every person, behold, this is a great merchant. He trades in everything, and thus he understands the necessity to learn from the other, and is called wise. So if we go into all those interactions and we're not thinking about judging, we're just thinking about learning, we're just thinking about, I'm like all of the professions because I can learn from the way your hat is made, and I can learn from the way that your suit is sewn, and I can learn from the way that you talk and the way that you act and the ideas that you share, then we're paying attention to all of those things on purpose, and we're in the present moment when we're engaging with the other person. And this quote from Pirkei Avot is also pretty self-explanatory. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel was accustomed to say, "Al tazin et chavercha ad shetageh limkomo." Don't judge your fellow until you come to his place. We have to always understand there's a whole story behind, and just be curious in our interactions with others. Let me get to know you. Let me hear your story. Let me hear your perspective. I just heard on Shabbos from Rabbi Robinson from Akkor. He said it's well known, and I'm like, oh no, why did I not know this? But now I know. He said it's well known that the word pikeach, which means smart, is double the gematria of tzad, which means side, because a smart person understands there's always two sides and is always trying to get to understand what is the other perspective on any given issue. Okay.
What was the word? I'm sorry.
Pikeach. is double the gematria of sad. Okay, the last source that I brought here is from Bereshit. You might remember this story of Avram and Sarah having a little argument about Hagar and Ishmael. Sarah thinks they're a bad influence. They need to be sent out of the house. And Avram says, well, this is kind of my wife and son, so I don't, you know, I really can't let them go. And Hashem says to Avraham, Al yirabei necha, al hanar v'al matecha. It shouldn't be bad in your eyes about your son, about your maidservant. Kol asher tomari lecha Sarah, shma bikola. Everything that Sarah says, listen bikola. Listen in her voice. And there's something about that he doesn't say listen to her voice, but he says, like, listen in her voice, right? And when somebody's talking to you, there's not only what they're saying, but there's
where it's coming from,
right? Like, the meaning behind it. The Mefarshim talk about how there was the Ruach HaKodesh behind it. Sarah had this nevuah. She knew what was going to happen in the future. She knew this was the right thing. Not everybody that we're talking to always has Ruach HaKodesh, but they have something that's making them say what they're saying. They have some intuition, some background that's provoking whatever they're saying. So don't just listen to their voice, but listen in their voice. Really listen. Okay, so those were our first two models, the model of Brachot and the model of Chesed. The third model I want to talk about is Tefillah, is prayer. And this is probably the most obvious example, because to be mindful and to have Kavana, I wouldn't say it's exactly the same word, but it's very similar. When we're davening, we want to be thinking about the meaning of the words that we're saying. But ultimately, the number one Kavana is to be with God, is to just be cognizant that I'm standing before God. And just like when we're doing chesed, we want to just be with that person and be totally present. When we're with God, we want to be totally present with God. So I wanted to share this excerpt from Rav Kook, from this book called Musar Avicha. It's even longer than this, and I brought a lot of it because it all connects to what we're talking about with mindfulness, but I'm only going to read the underlying parts here that connect to prayer. He starts with this quote from Mishlei. In Mishlei it says, "Bechol derechecha da'ehu," in all of your paths know God. Right? That means whatever we're doing in life is an opportunity to encounter God, and we should seek God in everything that we do. And this pasuk is called, it's referred to as a parsha katana, a tiny chapter. And usually how that's understood is it's a tiny chapter because it's just three words, but it's saying so much. This is really what Judaism is all about. Bechol derechecha da'ehu. In everything you do, you want to encounter God. So he brings this pasuk and he says, when a person is engaged in prayer, then they should seek the Blessed Holy One in their understanding of the subject matter, and in the proper intention in the heart's faith relating to the subject matter of that particular prayer. They should not seek out extraneous ideas at that time, because the person is engaged in that act of worship. Sorry, it should be, because when the person is engaged in that act of worship, the Blessed Holy One, so to speak, dwells even from his own perspective in that very act of worship specifically, and he can be found within it and nowhere else. I'm not even sure I totally understand what Cook is saying. I'm not sure how it completely relates to how this is really explaining Bechol derechecha da'ehu, but I thought maybe what he means is, on the one hand, Bechol derechecha da'ehu, and every single path you go down in your life, every single activity that you do, there's always a way to reach God through that thing. But on the other hand, you can only go down one path at a time, right? At any given time, you can only go down one path. So it's like God is waiting for you there on whatever path you're on. And if you're thinking about anything else, then you're not going to meet him. If you're even thinking about something that at a different time could be an appropriate way to connect with Hashem, I'm thinking about as I'm davening, I'm thinking about a chesed that I'm going to do today, or I'm thinking about something that I learned in Torah, but at that moment, God is only there in the tefillah that you're saying. So to the extent that I thoroughly apply myself to this tefillah, and I really try to think about the words that I'm saying, and I think about the fact that I'm standing before God, I will encounter Hashem in this tefillah. And if I don't, I'm going to be missing out on that experience. If you skip to the next page, the next underlined part, he explains this term, a parsha katana, in a different way. Before I said this pasuk, "Behold, Rachachadei," was a parsha katana because it's a few words, but it speaks volumes. He explains it differently. He says this teaching from Proverbs is termed a small chapter in Brachot, as it doesn't command greatness and breadth of wisdom and insight, just the opposite. It encourages a narrowing of focus to only the specific action a person is engaged in. So it's asking us, again, like, not to multitask. It's asking us not to cast our net so big, but just do one thing. Just do whatever you're doing right now. If it's davening, just daven and do it 100%. And in any area, all of the fundamental principles of the Torah depend on this, because it's only through this practice that anything becomes proper, and then a person finds the ultimate honor of the Blessed Holy One. May he be blessed. This could be a whole shiur within itself. I mean, I can't even get into right now, like, how to work on Kavana. The Hasidim HaRishonim, the Hasidim of the olden days, they used to spend an hour preparing before they daven, just to get themselves in the mindset, I'm about to greet God, and let me clear my head of everything else. I find that if I can even take 1 minute before I daven and just recognize this is a mindfulness opportunity, I'm going to try to stay in one place without walking around. I'm going to try to look in my sitter. I'm going to try to ignore everything else that's going on and just pay attention to the words that I'm saying. Even that 1 minute of preparation makes the difference and helps it to be a more meaningful experience. So I think with all of these opportunities, if we can kind of just take a second before anything that we're doing and say, I want to be mindful as I'm doing this. Let me just take a second and collect myself and be present. It helps make that a more meaningful, more connected experience. Okay, so far we had brachot, which are bringing us into the moment so that we don't take our experiences for granted. We had chesed, which is asking all the elements of mindfulness, be in the moment, pay attention on purpose, don't judge. And then we had tefillah, which is asking us really to clear our mind and focus only on what we're doing. Model number four is mitzvot. Chesed is a mitzvah, and so a lot of the things that I just talked about with chesed are going to apply to mitzvot in general, but I want to talk about two aspects of mitzvot which connect to mindfulness. The first one is, again, paying attention. Because just like chesed, mitzvot have these principles behind them, and depending on the particular time and place, you have to figure out how the principles apply. So, for example, there are many things which other religions will possibly label as just good or bad, and Judaism says, it depends. Right? The same action, depending on the time and place, could be a mitzvah, could be an aveira. So is food good or bad? It depends. Is cake good or bad? It depends. Is alcohol good or bad? It depends. And this idea is what we call kedusha. Making those decisions relates to the idea of kedusha. The pasuk in Vayikra, the beginning of Parshat Kedoshim, says, "Daber al kol adat b'nei Yisrael v'amarta lehem kedoshim tiyu ki kedosh ani Hashem lokechem." We are charged with being kadosh, holy. And the root of kadosh, kadash, the shorish, means to be separate. So there's different opinions. What does that mean? How do we become holy by being separate? But the way that the Ramban explains it, it's a long Ramban, so I brought just... I tried to shorten it to as much as I could. He says, according to my opinion, this separation is not to separate from sexual transgressions like the words of Rashi, but rather the separation is the one mentioned in every place in the Talmud where its practitioners are called those who have separated themselves. They're called prushim. And the manner is that the Torah prohibited sexual transgressions and forbidden foods and permitted sexual relations between husband and wife and the eating of meat and drinking of wine. If so, a desirous person will find a place to be lecherous with his wife or have many wives or to be among the guzzlers of wine and the gluttons of meat. He will speak as he pleases about all the vulgarities, the prohibition of which is not mentioned in the Torah, and behold, he would be a scoundrel with the permission of the Torah. Naval Bershut HaTorah. Meaning you could follow every other mitzvah in the Torah exactly and still be a bad person. And that's where this mitzvah comes in, to be kadosh, to be separate, that you also have to use your judgment. Yes, I'm allowed to have wine in Judaism, but is this the right way and the right time and the right amount? Therefore, the scripture came and specified the prohibitions that it completely forbade and commanded a more general rule that we should be separated from the indulgence of those things that are permissible, which means that we really always have to be on our toes. We always have to be paying attention in the present moment on purpose. Is this the right time? Is this the right place? That's the first aspect of mitzvot that require mindfulness. The second aspect is this idea of kavana, and we know that the mitzvot that we do, ideally we should have kavana, we should have a certain intent. I said before that kavana isn't exactly mindfulness. I think kavana is like mindfulness 2.0, because mindfulness says pay attention on purpose in the present moment, which is what kavana is asking us to do, but kavana is also intent. It's not just like be aware of what you're doing. Oh, hey, that's interesting, I'm eating. But it's also, what's your intent when you're eating? Take it to the next level by saying, I'm eating because this act is somehow spiritual. I'm eating because I want to gain energy, because I have so many, you know, important things that I want to do today, and I want to be totally present with my family, and I want to be totally present with my friends, and I want to be present in my job, and I want to have energy to be there for other people, and I want to have energy to daven and energy to do mitzvot, then what you're doing becomes now an elevated activity. So what's interesting about kavana is, even though we're supposed to have kavana in every mitzvah that we do, most mitzvot, you're still yosei if you didn't have kavana. You still did the mitzvah and it had whatever effect that it could have, even if you didn't have kavana, even if you didn't have the appropriate intent as you were doing it. However, there are some exceptions to this. One exception is Shema. The Rambam says one who reads Shema does not concentrate his mind while reciting the first verse has not fulfilled his duty. And that's... Did anybody go in October? I also didn't realize this until after I'd already started preparing this year. Rabbi Brand apparently gave a shiur about mindfulness in October. Did anybody go to it? It was a Sunday morning shiur? Great, okay. I was hoping that, because I'm like, oh no, I don't want people comparing my shiur to Rabbi Brand's shiur. Anyway, in his shiur, he talked about how there's an inconsistency in the Rambam, that sometimes he says you need to have kavana, and sometimes he says you don't need to have kavana. And the answer is, like everything, it depends. And with the mitzvah of Shema specifically, the whole idea of saying Shema is that we're being mekabel ol malchut shemayim, that at that moment we're accepting upon ourselves the yoke of heaven. And if you don't think about what you're doing, then you're not doing it. So that's Shema. You need to have kavana. And there, honestly, there have been times that I've said the first sentence of Shema like 3 or 4 times, saying, okay, that did not work out. Let me clear my head and let me start again. Because you want to make sure that you really got it when you've said it. And there's also a concept here. It's talking about blowing shofar. One who, I wasn't really sure exactly how to translate this, this idea of the term mitaseik is like doing something, but you're not really having the intention to do the mitzvah. So I put here like one who dabbles in shofar blowing. Like maybe you're trying it out, or you're just seeing if you could get a sound out of it, but you're not really intending to do the mitzvah. In order to learn does not fulfill his obligation. Because you need to have the mindset that you're doing the mitzvah. And especially if you're going to be motzi somebody else, if you're going to exempt somebody else from their obligation by the mitzvah that you're doing, if you're not paying attention to doing the mitzvah, then you cannot exempt somebody else. So that's the second aspect of mitzvot that really demand that we be paying attention, that we have a certain kavana as we're doing the mitzvah. And I found this article by Dr. Aviva Goldstein, who's an educator and family therapist, I think, in Jerusalem. And she wrote this article, I guess it must have been around Pesach time that she wrote the article, because a lot of it was about Pesach. But she wrote in general about mitzvot and how mitzvot demand mindfulness. And because she is a therapist, she's looking at the world and seeing there's so much inattentiveness nowadays, and mindfulness is really a remedy for inattentiveness. So she says, when we eat the designated shiur of matzah, we employ mind, body, and spirit to fulfill the mitzvah. Leaning to the left, we chew in silence, avoiding conversation to encourage our minds, to concentrate on the purpose of the moment, reflecting on the mitzvah of remembering the suffering of our people, and the remarkably glorious redemption from slavery to freedom. This moment of purposefully eating the matzah with kavana, concentration, while being fully present and engaged is actually an ancient prescription for a contemporary ailment. Our society is plagued by the affliction of inattentiveness. The beauty of mindfulness is that a knowledgeable Jew does not have to veer off the path of Yiddishkeit to tap into it. It is, in fact, the essence of Yiddishkeit. We just call it something else. We call it kavana. When we make a bracha with kavana before eating, that's mindfulness. When we say Asher Yetzer with kavana after using the bathroom, that's mindfulness. When we bench with our children on Leil Shabbos with kavana, that's mindfulness. And when we eat matzah in silence on Pesach, savoring the taste, reflecting on the moment, and listening to the soundtrack of the crunching, that's mindfulness. Yeah?
I'm thinking, though, of marriage. Supposedly, if you say the word, a man says the words to a woman, Hareya Mekudeshet Li, he doesn't need the kavana. He can be married to her if they both fulfill the halachic requirements, and he'd have to get a get for saying that even as a joke. So then how does that fit in with the rest of this where you need mindfulness? Nothing could be more important than marriage.
Right. That's a really good point. I don't know. I could get back to you on that, though.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a really great point. I don't even totally understand in general how you know, I said most of the mitzvot that we do not require kavana. It's ideal that we have kavana, but we can still fulfill the mitzvah even if we don't have kavana. And I don't really understand why. I think your example is a great example. How can that's like a real commitment. How can you make that commitment if you're not thinking
it's
about it?
It's up to the woman to have figured that out before they're standing.
That's a good question. I'll look into it. Thank you. Okay, but that's the idea behind mitzvot, and I think it's so cool how each holiday that we have as Jews, each holiday has its own theme, which is this really abstract concept like freedom or community or whatever the theme of each holiday is. And then we have these like really tangible mitzvot that bring us into the moment and make us feel what that theme is. We all know when Rosh Hashanah comes what Rosh Hashanah smells like and what it tastes like and what it feels like. And we all know what Sukkot, you know. So these mitzvot are really trying to bring us into the moment and make us fully present and feeling that. And the last model I want to talk about is Shabbos. I think for anybody who has trouble just being in the present moment, Shabbos is the medicine for that. On Shabbos, we're told that we're not allowed to do any malacha. That's the pasuk here in Shmot, lo tasek kol malacha, which is translated here as don't do any work. But malacha is not the same as avodah. It's not typical work. Malacha is creative work. The 39 things that were done in the creation of the Mishkan, that's what we're not allowed to do on Shabbos. You're allowed to work. Shabbos is sometimes a lot of work if you're like hosting and, you know, the kids are home the whole day. So you're working, right? But it's not, you're not creating. Whatever you've prepared before Shabbos, that's what you have. And then you're just there. And you have to just deal with what is, appreciate what is. Shabbos is used as a frame of reference to talk about Olam Haba, to talk about the world to come. And here it says in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, it says, one who takes pains on Shabbat Eve will eat on Shabbat. But one who did not take pains on Shabbat Eve, from where will he eat on Shabbat? If you prepare ahead of time, you have whatever you need on Shabbos. If you don't, you don't. You just have to be with what is. It's compared also to a person on a boat. Whatever you take on the boat with you, that's what you have. And once that boat sets sail, there's nothing else that you can do, right? So that's Shabbos, and that's Olam Haba, that's the world to come. Whatever we prepared in this world, that's what we have, and then we just are there, and we appreciate it. And that's Shabbos also. To the extent, the last source here is that we don't even ask for our needs on Shabbos. We don't even have this long Shemona Esrei. We ask for everything that we need, even if, God forbid, a person is sick. You know, typically, we don't even daven for the things that we need because it's not about trying to fix things or trying to change things. If the wine spills on the tablecloth, it's just going to sit there until the end of Shabbos. And you just have to be like, you just have to be there with it. It's fine. It's fine. We're just going to sit and be with what is. You can't even, you know, travel out of a certain distance because you're just going to be here in the present moment. And that's what Shabbos is all about. So those were my five models. I'm sure that there are many others that you can think about in your daily life that connect to mindfulness. And I hope that like I said, I hope that this is like a support group and we can all, you know, if we're all working on mindfulness, we can help each other and let each other know when we discover another opportunity for working on mindfulness, but if we could just recognize these opportunities in our daily practice as Jews, take a moment before we go into them to center ourselves and to make it more meaningful, then hopefully we'll lead more mindful and connected lives. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah.